This is the WTOP Book Report. I'm Tariq King. My guest today was a Silicon Valley soccer mom who descended into opioid addiction and ended up spending some time in jail, only to emerge like a phoenix from the ashes as a respected ghostwriter. Her memoir is out. It's compelling. I've read it. And it's called The Many Lives of Mama Love. It's my pleasure to welcome Lara Love Hardin to the Book Report today. And let's go to that conversation. Lara Love Hardin, thank you so much for joining me today on The Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've read your memoir and it reads like a novel, and it reminds me of that adage, you can't make this stuff up. Truth is stranger than fiction. So it's a pleasure to have you. So if you could please just tell our listeners, what is the book about?
It is the story of my journey from soccer mom in the suburbs to opiate addict to committing crimes to fund my addiction to pleading guilty to 32 felonies. And spending a year in jail. And then, you know, the second half of the book is really a journey to figure out if I'm more good than bad. You know, I spent a lot of time in my work becoming good adjacent, thinking that could prove to myself in the world that I was more good than bad. And, you know, I learned to ghostwrite in jail. I started ghostwriting. So it's really a story also of the power of books and writing to heal. And yeah, it's a crazy story. I'm also a literary agent, so I represent those kind of stories. So this is my 13th book I've written and the first book I've written as myself.
So before we get into Lara in the Pokey, right? what did your life look like on that day that the police came knocking on your door? I understand you owned a pet cemetery business. And what did it look like, at least on the surface?
So, I mean, it didn't look this way on that day, but up until that day, which is really the culmination of a whole year, and, you know, the book couldn't be that long. But prior to this, you know, I owned a business, a pet cemetery. I had 4 children and 2 stepchildren, so 6 children in private school. I lived on a cul-de-sac in Aptos, California, very suburban neighborhood where my neighbors loved me. And, you know, when my last son was born, they brought over meals. And I was really playing the role of perfectly happy person in a perfectly happy life. And that wasn't the case. You know, I had struggled on and off with addiction, and as is the nature of it, had fallen back into it for numerous reasons. A little bit I get into the book, but mostly the reason is that that's what happens, you know, and an addiction's progressive. And the book starts really at the end of almost a year of active addiction, and I lost all my money. I was stealing from my neighbors and my mom friends at school drop off, and everything was kind of closing in on me. And I knew I couldn't stop, and I also desperately knew things were out of control and I needed to be stopped. So that's kind of the happy place where it starts.
And so when they came knocking on your door, you were arrested. You landed in the county jail with a $250,000 bail set. You were detoxing, and of course, you were worried out of your mind about the whereabouts of your nearly 4-year-old son who was home with you the day that you got arrested. And you ended up being charged with 32 felonies.
Yeah, 32 felonies.
As I was reading the memoir, I was surprised that you never wrote of experiencing abject terror the way that most people think they'd experience it if they were locked up. You know, we think of jail as a place of nonstop violence, torture, misery. But what do you think it was about you as a person that really enabled you to sort of see the people and the dynamics around you? If you were completely, you know, out of your mind with fear, you didn't write that. It seemed like you didn't have time for fear. You were just sort of figuring out what was going on and then really looking at the people and the dynamics around you.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I think I had fear. I had abject internal fear, terror, but it wasn't about the people I was in jail with. My terror in jail came from the people running the jail more. It came from my internal world and like I've completely imploded my life and I failed at life and there's no future and how am I ever going to have the internal fortitude to get through what's in front of me? You know, and I had a dark night where I didn't think I was going to do that, you know, but what I found like really interesting is like, people make a family wherever they are in whatever circumstances, in my opinion, you know? And so 80% of the women in jail are mothers, right? 80% are mothers in jail. And so there were more things we had in common. We're all going through the same thing. And so, you know, it wasn't all like, you know, a picnic in the park, but But overall, what I found is people were supporting each other. And, you know, there were issues, but really they came from the guards. They came from the system. They came from the power structures in there. And, you know, there are a lot of clear rules about how to work things out in jail that I figured out pretty quickly. And, you know, I said it wasn't like that different from a PTA meeting, honestly, if like you get down to the core of people and their motivations and their struggles and their power struggles. It wasn't, you know.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about that. Like, what did you see as commonalities between, it sounds to me like you're talking about sort of pecking order, etiquette, things like that. Like, can you draw some parallels between the relationship dynamics in jail and at the PTA meeting in a more kind of specific way? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's power struggles at a PTA meeting over, you know, might be over fundraising or who's in control or who's delegating things, you know, or, you know, who's more important to take on this role. And so, and I think you get that in any group potentially. So, you know, I approached it that way. Maybe no one else had that way of seeing it, but that's what I knew. But, you know, there was like rules and expectations and an etiquette to follow in jail that I quickly learned that wasn't that different, I guess.
You were 41 years old, upper middle class, white woman. Had you ever even given any consideration to what life must be like in jail?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a family that was chaos. There was a lot of police knocking on my door and a lot of trouble. There's a lot of addiction and alcoholism, violence in my family. I had a fear, not of going to jail, but I always had a fear of being in trouble, if that makes sense.
It
it wasn't specifically around jail, but I always had this feeling the other shoe is going to drop. And this is, you know, like in my addiction or out of my addiction, you know, this always fear of like, am I in trouble with someone? I don't like that being in trouble, that sort of anxiety of that. But, you know, the women in jails are built for men, honestly. Like there's been a 750% increase in incarceration rates for women over the last three decades, right? The power structure in jail, like if you look at the red flags for domestic violence, like you read one of those warning sheets you're going to get somewhere, you know, is he controlling who you have access to? Is he controlling, you know, your friends and family, when you eat, what you wear? Like, it's really interesting to me because I was like, this is the same power structure in jail because it was all male guards. And the women in jail, I don't know the statistic, I wish I did, but the, you know, the rate of women in jail who've been domestic violence survivors, sexual assault, it's way higher than the normal population. So you have a group of traumatized women in this power structure. And the reasons women go to jail are often interpersonal reasons, you know, because of their boyfriend who's a drug dealer. You know, I would talk to the women there and I just, you know, they were sharing stories. One shared me the story of being gang raped. And I was like, well, what did your family do to help? And she's like, no, they kicked me out. Like, you know, I was in a place too, where I didn't feel like empowered to advocate for myself, but it's, you know, it's always easier for me to advocate for someone else. So it was really eye-opening and I had all this mother energy to give. And so I gave it where I could, you know.
There's a mantra in the book and in your life. It was kind of an important one for a time. Real power is quiet power.
Quiet power.
Tell us how that helped you in jail politics and how that ultimately led to the nickname Mama Love.
So there's a power structure in jail and there's a woman who was in control, who's the shot caller in jail. Her name is Daddy. And you know, one day, and things, depending on what's going on in people's court dates, you know, think tensions, you feel the tensions are different, the mood's different, you know, you have a lot of women under one small roof. So an incident happened where Daddy got embarrassed publicly there, and she was in conflict with someone else. And really in that moment, you know, like I had six children, I was just like, I just need some quiet, right? So I pulled Daddy aside and I whispered this real power is quiet power thing to her. And we went off and she's like, tell me more. And it changed the whole dynamic in there because instead of fighting with this woman, she just stayed silent all day. And Daddy's not someone who stayed silent, and she didn't eat, I think. And then every hour went on, this made the woman who she was in conflict with completely uncomfortable. And until finally she got herself rolled up, which means she asked the guards to come take her out of there, which is what you do when someone's not following those politics in jail. So I helped Daddy save face, and this became sort of the mantra in there with everyone trying to, you know, out quiet flex on each other, right? And so at that point, I was new at jail. I was because I had no street cred there. I had nothing, you know, to offer. And so after that whole incident, I got moved up to the top tier. And because I was older and because I had, you know, I started writing poems about people and that, like, people felt seen, as you do when you write about them. So the power dynamic really changed in there. You know, I got to, you know, be my version of the shot caller in jail, like PTA president, right?
I'm just curious, how long in time did it take from showing up at the jail to becoming shot caller?
I mean, it was a few weeks. Wasn't that long?
That doesn't happen to everybody, Ms. Harden.
Yeah. Yeah. And then later when I moved over to the sort of minimum security, I controlled the kitchen. So I would say that, and the woman who controls the cheese in jail controls the jail. So that was like, you know, I controlled the food at that point in the minimum security. So that helped also.
She who controls the cheese controls the
controls
jail.
Controls the women.
I literally laughed out loud when I read it. And there's a reason. There's a reasoning behind that. But we're going to have people pick up the book. Before you were released in jail, you started performing the services, performing a service for your fellow inmates that was sort of a foreshadowing of your ultimate future career, right? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah. So it was before I was released, but after sentencing, and I got moved over from the main part next door to the more minimum security where you have a little bit more comfort and freedom. And so I started writing letters for the women I was in jail with. You know, again, 80% of women in jail are mothers of minor children, often the sole caregivers. So I would, you know, write to their judge on their behalf. So I'd write as them. Right. And to get them asked to be sentenced to a long-term residential drug treatment program rather than prison, or to get a pass for a funeral or a high school graduation or some event going on in their children's lives. And so I would write very persuasive letters on their behalf. And after talking to them and hearing their story, and then I would write as them. And so I got a lot of women their passes to do that, and a lot of people from prison to treatment or modified sentences or whatever it was. And, you know, I got to exercise that writing muscle that I had not exercised in a long time.
So after you get out of jail, you are looking for a job, not easy to find. You ended up working for a literary agent. You were offered the job, but there was a little bit of a scare before you actually got it in earnest. Talk about that.
So, you know, I answered this Craigslist ad for literary agency. And, you know, you never know with the Craigslist ad if you're going to get a job or be murdered. You know, that was my, I was like, well, I'm going to go. And so I got the job. You know, I had my background, but I didn't, you know, I had a don't ask, don't tell policy about my criminal background. If they'd asked, I would have told them, but I would have been crazy to volunteer that information. And so I was there about 2 weeks into the job, and the person who hired me Googled me. And, you know, when I was sentenced, my face was on the front page of the newspaper with a not very pleasant headline calling me the neighbor from hell. And, you know, this man had just offered me the job based on my skills and my intelligence, and I was doing great so far. And he read this article, and his face, I remember his face went white and just looked at me like I, you know, was the devil all of a sudden, you know. And it was this moment, and I thought, oh, this dream job is over, you know. And it was just a part-time little job then. And I left. He said, come back tomorrow. And I left. And I was like, there's no way I'm going back there. Like, I can't. Like, I was embarrassed. I was humiliated. I was ashamed. I was defeated. I was like, I will never be able to be more than this thing that I have done, right? And I did go back the other day. I had a very sleepless night. And, you know, it was a literary agency that worked with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And he said, you know, I can't work with Arch and not walk my talk. And so he believed in me and gave me a chance. And, you know, it helped that he had just like called me brilliant the day before. So when I went back, I was like, look, I'm just as brilliant as I was yesterday when you didn't know this about me. And, you know, and you know, he had to take a leap of faith in me. And I, you know, ended up working there for 12 years.
And you co-authored innumerable books. I don't have the whole list, but I know that you mentioned Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And then you met Mr. Ray Hinton, and you worked on his book. We're running out of time, but please be sure. Tell me about that and what it meant to your journey.
Working with Anthony Ray Hinton, I, you know, we represented Brian Stevenson for a book called Just Mercy. And Brian called and asked if we'd come meet with this man. He, an innocent man who had been on death row and Holman Prison in Alabama for 30 years. And Brian had just gotten him out. And so I went there to meet with him. And, you know, Mr. Hinton, Ray's experience and mine was very different, but the fact that I knew what it was like to be alone, you know, and isolated from the world and have that door shut and lock and be referred to by a number, like, it comforted him. We bonded instantly. He was innocent. I was super guilty, but he trusted me to tell his story. Like, a middle-aged white woman from California was the last person he thought would help him tell his story of growing up in Alabama. But we found a lot of common ground, and we worked on that book, The Sun Does Shine. And that's the one Oprah chose for a book club. So it was really, you know, and Ray's amazing. And I learned so much from him about gratitude. And, you know, he has no bitterness, like so much from all the books I've worked on. But that one was special, you know.
And it was like a full circle moment. You actually laying your personal truth on the line and having that be the thing that connects you to this author, right?
I spent 10 years keeping a secret from all these amazing, non-judgy, wonderful spiritual leaders and people that I was so afraid that they would find out about my past, you know? And I thought, if I'm super good adjacent, you know, that goodness will, you know, still trying to convince the world of my goodness and convince myself that I was more good than bad. But Brian Stevens is like one of the first authors I told my story for. And he was like, oh, cool, great. That'll help you with Ray's book. You know, like, it was such a non-event. And I had built it up to this big life world ending thing, you know, and it was really an eye opener of how harshly I was judging myself and unforgiving and not letting myself move past the worst thing I've done. Because when the secret was out, I just felt such a lightness. And, you know, getting to meet Oprah and having her talk to me about power and what real power is from her perspective, which she did at a lunch after that announcement, was this full circle moment from that time with Daddy. That one of those things that you can't, if you fictionalize, it would be unbelievable. And it was true. And it was really, I was lucky enough to work with these amazing people who helped me evolve in what I was going through.
I think you had to go that whole way, that whole path, to end up ultimately facing and loving and appreciating yourself, and that we are not the worst things that we've ever done, and and the worst things that have ever happened to us, right? So what would you like people to take away from this journey?
Yeah, I mean, I spent so much time in shame, and it was such a waste of time that kept me present in my life. And I really learned to heal through this community. But I write in the book that the worst thing I've ever done is to create a whole identity out of this worst thing I've ever done. Like, that's what I had to learn, and just how much I needed to have compassion for the person I was who made some really bad life choices, right? And hurt people. But I had to allow myself to move beyond that, and that people are not as unforgiving as I thought they were, or as judgmental, and how much I need community and people to reach out to, you know?
And you find it in places where you absolutely least expect it. You found it in G Block. I know you think about these women, but do you ever hear from them? Are you in touch with any of them?
I'm in touch with, you know, the reality is, you know, a third or more are off at prison. About a third have passed away. There's a handful that are doing great. And we, some are coming to my, you know, some of the book events that I'm doing locally. And some were just Facebook friends, and I see them with their children and doing well. And we stay connected that way. Or, you know, maybe in a recovery community where things are more anonymous. But I, you know, some are doing well. And the hope is that more can do well.
Thank you for sharing your story. The book is phenomenal. Thank you so much for writing it and for sharing it. It's called The Many Lives of Mama Love. It is out from Simon & Schuster. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you on WTOP.
Thank you so much.
And I thank everyone for listening to this edition of The Book Report. For WTOP News, I'm Tariq King.